then other exciting random stuff that's turned up this morning. New caps, can't complain about that.
Cool. Looking
up all right. And extension things for gravel.
So
the problem I'm continually finding is I want something that's for Badlands. I want something that's comfortable and small and compact. Also, something that's quite high, so it's actually not that aggressive.
Yeah.
I've been talking to Zav for like, I don't even know how long about it, ages, trying to work out exactly what I can get away with in terms of stack height and the length of the bolts that are going to be relatively stable. And this is literally where I've got to. So these are like... the clip-on bars are just they're from Prime. Like,
okay,
they're really neat little carbon bars. They're Prime Noosa, they're called, but they only do like a 30 mil spacer, which is that one.
Yeah.
But then the actual profile design ones fit sort of, not perfectly. Like they sort of fit, like they'd be okay, but you have it on the other way around. So you have the one that it comes with on. Closer to the bar, then it doesn't clamp nicely. So this is the bodged solution that I've come up with, and I need to now whack this on my gravel bike and see how that is. So that's been my,
because you need it to be like pretty secure as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like I did Badlands last year, and I had like the profile design flip-on bars.
Yeah,
which in my head was like, that's a great thing because you've still got access then to the whole top of the handlebars and everything. But in reality, it makes the most annoying noise in the world because it just like rattles over every single, like on the road it rattles, let alone off-road.
Yeah.
So it's like all the time.
How long is Badlands?
This year, 740 kilometers. I think
which you really don't want rattle for 740K.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would do my head in. I'd get to a stage where I'd probably just like take them off and be like, no, gone.
Yeah, that was me. I debated it last year, but then I was like, what do I do with them? I just leave them on the side of a road or something, which just doesn't seem right to do either. I'm trying to find it, the Badlands. I think it's 740. Oh, here we go. No, I'm completely wrong. It's 771 kilometers this year.
Fair enough. That's,
And 15,000 meters of climbing. And it's probably...
That is long off-road.
Yes. So I've been like... I have started recording. I'm going to say that now. You probably heard he's recording. I'm actually going to... I know we're just talking general crap about bikes and stuff, but it's perfectly relevant because you are an absolute... tweaker of bikes like me. I think it's completely relevant. And I've got Hayley, who is a multiple national time trialist champ. I don't know how many multiples you can add to that. Commonwealth Games medalist, like kind of one/ podiumed in pretty much everything you can think of in the terms of time trialing, aero bike racing. You know, did you do really well at hill climbs as well?
I won the national hill climb in 2019 when it was on Hator. And set the course record on it.
Wasn't that one that was not that hilly though for a hill climb?
Well, it's long. It's the kind of hill climb that I like because it's long and like, but I have no sprint. So the hill climbs that are like 1 minute or 2 minutes, I'm never going to be great because like I physically can't hurt myself enough over a short duration to like do that well. Once it gets to like, actually my 2 minute power's all right, but once you get to like 3 minutes, 4 minutes onwards, I just get better and better. So for me, when I kind of look at the national hill climb, you know, most years and say, okay, well, what course is it on? Is it a decent length climb? If it is, then maybe I'll give it a whack at the end of my season.
It's such a great unique British event as well.
They're so fun, like they're really fun. The atmosphere is great, everyone's so friendly. like I really enjoy doing them. It's just that often, like, I will have been racing through to, you know, pretty much mid-October anyway. And then it's like, well, have I done a qualifying event if I potentially need one? And then, like, you know, and then does the course actually suit me? Or is it better to just kind of take my off-season break a week earlier or 2 weeks earlier and then start training earlier? So it's always a bit of a toss-up about whether I do it or not.
Yeah. I've never really done hill climbing, but I feel like this winter I might do some because it's different. That's literally it, because it's different. I say that, but my next, basically from September until November, is just like carnage. For some reason, like, ultra stuff seems to get really busy around sort of now, July, August until November. It's really, really busy. So I don't know how much I'm going to do, but I have actually very intentionally set up a bike as a hill climb bike, which is my old Cervelo R5.
Right.
And when I say I've set it up as a hill climb bike, basically I've put a single chainring on the front and the biggest cassette I could fit on it. That's literally all I've done. I haven't changed anything else. I always just thought, like, doing a one by road bike where it's got the gear ratios which actually are all right for going uphill is kind of cool.
That's
basically it. And I didn't actually have a front mech, so I was like, I'll do as an excuse. I could just pretend that it's a hill climb bike now. I haven't weighed it. I never weigh bikes. It's one of those things that, like, everyone asks about it and I'm like, I don't really care. Because it's like one of those things that then ends up, but especially, like, everyone asks about it on ultra bike packing things. Oh, what's your setup weigh? And I'm just like, oh, it's just heavy. It doesn't matter. It gets to a point where, well, once it's heavy, it really doesn't actually matter what it weighs. Like, it's just a solid weight. And for some reason, that attitude of never weighing bikes has gone into everything now. Like, when I did the Everest, I didn't weigh the bikes. I don't want to know it.
I do when I've done hill climbs, but, like, in the past when I've done hill climbs, like the national hill climb, you know, I was doing it on my team bike from that year. So it has to start out at least the UCI minimum weight, which is 6.8.
Yeah.
But then very few, but particularly on, like, smaller UCI teams, you're very unlikely to actually have a bike that is on that minimum. Mm-hmm. So then it's like, okay, what can I do to get this bike a little bit lighter, or, like, as light as I can without doing something stupid? Because I'm not a kind of, like, saw off half my handlebars and drill holes in my saddle kind of person. It's like, I'll take the bottle cages off, I'll take the bar tape off, I'll take any, like, erroneous, like, electrical tape off, and maybe the like bung, headset bung. And then it's like, have I managed to get it under 6 kilos? No, but it's kind of close, so I'll just go with it. Whereas you've got, like, the mega, mega hill climbers who are, like, they've got all the extra light components. They've got, like, you know, tiny little bars because they've sawed half their bars off. And for me, the hill climb is normally just, like, a fun thing that I might do at the end of the season. And, like, I'm not really training specifically for it, which is why, again, like, for me, it's better if they're longer ones, because I will have been training for events that are, like, well, you know, maybe TTs, so something that's like a 20K type TT in October, or even actually one, I think it was 2017 when I did the hill climb, and I didn't win, I was second or third. And in the space of like two and a half weeks, I'd done a 21K TT, 4-hour Taiwan King of the Mountains challenge, and then a, like, you know, 4 or 5 minute hill climb. And like, you can't spread yourself that thin with training to do really, really well at all of them. So, like, for me, you know, like, I wouldn't really want to be training for like 1 or 2 minute hill climbs, just because that doesn't really fit in with the rest of what I'm doing so well.
I mean, surely I think there's like an element of, I think my stance on it has always been never be way too honed, because I would never be incredible at one thing. I've always had that mindset of like, oh, I'm just going to be good at a variety of different things, because it keeps it exciting and interesting for me. But when you're if you are very much a specialist person, and I mean this in a good way, you very are a specialist time trialing person, or, you know.
I mean, I'm not trying to be bad at sprinting. I just am. Yeah. I would love if I could be better. But I mean, you know, I guess if I'm going to be a one-trick pony, having a TT engine is useful because it does also translate well into, you know, road races, long climbs in road races. Mm-hmm, because actually, you know, when I've had some of my best road results, it's been either when I've managed to get away and sustain a solo break. Yeah. So I won a stage of Lotto Touring and Ladies Tour in 2017 doing that. I managed to get off the front of the bunch, get to the back of a break, overtake the break, and then rode the last 11K solo, which, you know, engine. And I actually got away on a climb. So it's like, you know, consistent power to weight. Mm-hmm. And then that same year, I was sixth on the Queen stage of Emakumeen Bira in Spain. I was 6 seconds behind Annemiek van Vleuten and Ashley Norman Patio. And that stage finished on a 13.5K climb. Mm-hmm. So it's like, that's the kind of thing that like my TT engine kind of translates well to. So
exactly.
If I'm going to have one trick, I prefer to have that trick, I think.
I think it's, and I would agree, I'd probably say of the tricks in cycling, it's the one that actually is probably the most versatile. Like,
yeah,
you maybe can't necessarily sprint, but you can still put down a lot of power. You may not necessarily be able to climb like the ultra lightweight climbers, like, as you say, Vleuten or Moomin Pasio, but you can sustain high numbers on steady gradients. It's just when it gets like very, very sharp and steep where it becomes tricky. And you know, the whole, and also winning from a breakaway is surely, as a pro, that's like the dream situation. Or I would say, I was a pro, that would, for me, would be the dream, is winning from a breakaway. Like, you can have your sprints or whatever, but, or mountain finishes, but a breakaway finish always is the one that everyone goes, wow, that's cool, it's really cool.
Yeah, you're never going to win as much, but being able to win solo, or like getting away from a small break or something like that is cool.
It looks great. You think about it. I mean, Van Vleuten has done it way too many times that it's almost predictable. You know, it's like there's certain riders I look at and I think, oh, you're a little bit predictable. And like with her, it's like, is it just that she is actually genuinely that incredibly good, or
she is insane? She's insane.
Ridiculous, isn't she? And
she trains really hard. So I'm on Movistar E team as of this end of December, start of January this year. And one of the things we did in January was the E team riders were invited for a few days on the Movistar camp.
Really cool.
And it was a little bit kind of sabotaged by COVID, in inverted commas, because originally the plan was that we would have done quite a bit of riding with the pro teams, and we would have like had all our meals with them and integrated more. But because in January there was another wave of COVID going around all the pro team camps, and obviously all the teams were starting to race again, they didn't want to take the risk of having, you know, unknown people kind of coming into their camp. So we didn't do that much with the kind of elite road teams. But you know, you could see Annemiek would go out training with the guys rather than the women's squad, because she likes having that extra push. She likes to be pushed out of her comfort zone rather than like being the strongest of the women's squad and like never really feeling as though she's being tested on some of these training rides. So she prefers to, even if she doesn't do the whole ride, I think sometimes she doesn't necessarily do the whole ride, or she just sits at the back the whole time. But for her, that's a better training stimulus. So all of these things she does and the decisions she makes around her training are all geared to, just being pretty incredible. And like, she's lucky in that because she is who she is, she can pick and choose her race calendar quite a lot. So unlike a lot of the other female riders, not just on Movistar, just in general, where it's like, okay, well, we've only got 10 riders on our calendar, on our roster, because that's how many we want to pay, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And now this person's ill and this person's injured, so that takes us to 8, and we need 6 for this race and 7 for this race. So it's like, well, no, you have to race. You can't just say, sorry, I'm on an altitude camp. Mm-hmm. Whereas Annemiek, a little bit, can be like, look, this is the event that I'm targeting this year, or these are the two events.
Mm-hmm.
To do really well in that, I know that I need to be training during this period. So I'll race A, B, C, and then I'm going to go back to altitude and train. Mm-hmm. And she's good enough and has the level of like knowledge and experience that she has, that she knows what she needs to do, and she's allowed to do it.
I think that's
one of the big things.
Yeah, it was a really interesting move, her going from, I think it was Bike Exchange at the time, or I'm not sure what they were called at the time, but her going to Movistar was, I think it caught a lot of people by surprise, actually.
I agree.
In all honesty, it's probably made the Movistar women's squad way more in the limelight. It's probably done better for the sponsors as well, in terms of, compared to the men's squad now. The men's squad, you know, we're hearing stories that they're very close, because we've got this whole relegation battle going on in the men's world. And Movistar, one of the oldest teams in cycling. You look at the history of that team, I don't know how many years it is, but the team, as Movistar or previous iterations of sponsors, has been one of the oldest going teams out there.
I think it is the longest running. I think outright the longest running professional cycling team under its various guises. I was going to say that, actually, because they're a really interesting team, because, as you say, you expect them to be much more traditional in a lot of their approach because of the history surrounding the team. But actually, as a team, they've really embraced a lot of new and up and coming things. So having an E team, you know, they've got an E team, they've got a men's and a women's team that are doing Zwift races, and not just having the E team and, like, you know, having, oh, we've got these 5 riders and they'll just race in like virtual Movistar kit. It's like, we got invited on their camp. We've all got a Canyon Ultimate bike. Mm-hmm. They send us turbo. We get discounts on other like products that the team is sponsored by. Yeah, we get a pair of physique shoes, we get the helmet, we get the glasses. So, like, actually, we get a lot of the, like, same sort of stuff, obviously not in the quantity, but we get a lot of the same sort of stuff as their pro teams.
Yeah.
And we also get, you know, if we wanted it, we could send a message and be like, look, could one of your, you know, physios give me advice on this? And when I told kind of my contact at Movistar that I was having to have surgery, which actually hasn't affected the e-racing because of it's fallen in between Zwift seasons. Mm-hmm. But when I said, like, I've got to have surgery, this is the time frame, this is when I'll be back on the bike, I should be back e-racing by this time. Hopefully I can do some, like, recovery rides as part of my rehab. You know, the message that I got was like, you know, if there's anything we can do to help or any support, let us know.
That's really nice.
So, yeah, for quite a traditional team, they're actually really, like, forward-thinking and inclusive. And it really does feel like a family. That's not just kind of, you know, propaganda that they're putting out on social media with the, like, you know, Movistar family. Like, it genuinely does feel more like that.
It's interesting, as you say, because, you know, we've sort of said they're a very old team in terms of the history and the stories of the team. You know, they've had some, I think some of the riders that have gone through that team in the past is pretty insane as well in the men's, on the men's side, through the heritage of it. And they are, I think, you know, one of the only World Tour men's and women's team that actually has a dedicated, like, e-racing team that I can think of. I'm trying to think if there's another one that does, but I can't think of one that does.
Canyon women's team does e-racing and did the Zwift Premier League this year, but obviously Canyon have the separate feed-in.
Yes.
Zwift, you know, get a contract on our team Zwift by Academy. Zwift.
Yeah,
the Zwift Academy. So that they have an e-team, but it's not like a dedicated e-team. So some of their riders, if it fits, will do the rounds of the Zwift Racing Series.
Which is the same as the Koenig Quickstep, isn't it, as well, I think?
Yeah, I think so. But I can't actually think of any. There's Wahoo Le Col as the alternative to Le Col Wahoo. But I think that's operated completely separately. I don't think there's actually any tie-in between the women's team and the E team. And yeah, I can't think of any other pro road team that have Swift teams.
Yeah. And do you think I'm a huge believer in the benefits of on like virtual training Swift. Like for me, anything that's like an overly structured training session, I'm quite happy just to sit and do it on Swift, because there's a couple of elements for it for me. Is one, I think consistency of sticking to the plan and the structure is much easier.
Yeah.
And the other big thing for me is I actually really like that I get very hot and sweaty, because especially doing races like Badlands, where heat acclimatization plays massively into it, doing a turbo session indoors when it's 30 degrees outside actually does help quite a lot.
Yeah, I think I'm going to use the turbo for some heat acclimation stuff as well. I have done in the past, but yeah, no, that is useful. But fun fact, I was really anti-Zwift. I really resisted. It kind of really exploded over lockdown.
Yes, of course.
And during lockdown, I think it was in the May 2020, I agreed to lead one of the like British Cycling endurance rides on a Saturday, like 90 minutes, mm-hmm. and got a Zwift account through that. I'll do it. So I joined one that somebody else was leading the week before, just to like see how it worked, and then led my one, and then literally didn't use Zwift again. Because for me, I'm motivated with training I'm motivated by kind of obviously winning races. And for me, if somebody writes down, you need to do A, B, C, D, I'll just do it. Even if it's miserable, even if I'm just on my turbo, you know, listening to music or watching Netflix or something.
Don't need the program to be.
Yeah. I don't need it. So I was a bit like, you know, I'm not really that bothered by Zwift. I won't do much more on it. And then I don't know whether you know, actually, I'm coached by Zav.
No, I didn't know that. That is cool. Yeah.
So Zav started coaching me in the November of 2020. So after I had my off-season break for the end of the 2020 season. So I had a break for a couple of weeks in October. And then Zav started coaching me that November. So obviously he was starting with me over a winter. And he'd sent me sessions on the turbo. He'd be like, Zav, I don't use the turbo anymore. Like, literally, like, I go out on the road. It's like, but what if the weather's shit? I'm like, I just put better clothes on. Like, I just train on the road, really. He's like, well, it would be good if you could do a few more things on the turbo, because there are some sessions that I just think work better on the turbo. Mm-hmm. Fine. Then I started riding the turbo again, like, when he told me to. But if he didn't tell me, I'd still be out on the road. And then we had a spell of bad weather, and I was like, fine, I'll train on the turbo. And he was like, well, just like, why don't you just run Zwift? Like, run Zwift in the background. Like, it is actually really useful. It changes gradients, so it makes it a bit more interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. So then I started using Zwift a bit more and really did see the benefits and just how good it was for making time pass quickly on the turbo.
Yes.
And like giving you that bit of motivation. And because I normally train alone, just because I don't have, you know, people who live around me who, you know, are so flexible with their training or training at the same kind of level, Zwift is a way where you do have that like competitive, you know, push as well, because it's like, especially for me as a female, often you get guys who are like, hang on, I've just been overtaken by a woman, I'm going to go really hard to try and re-overtake, and then and then I get competitive, so I push myself a bit harder. So I think I train a bit harder on Zwift than maybe I do in some of my base rides on the road.
Yeah.
And then Zav was like, well, you know, why don't we try a few Zwift races for training? And I just really got into them. So from being a real like resistant kind of person towards Zwift, being like, no, it's really popular and I'm not just gonna like jump on the bandwagon and go with it. I now really like it and, you know, would recommend it to other people as a training tool. And my husband now uses it as well, and he really loves it. So yeah, so it's basically a Zav that kind of helped me turn the corner with it.
I think with Zwift as well is, because I've actually used it since it was a beta. So I've used
it, okay.
And I am a paying subscriber and have been since then. So hi Zwift, I'm loyal.
Yeah.
Send me some love. you know, I've been a paying subscriber since it was a beta, and I basically heard about it because a friend of mine who lives in Amsterdam was helping doing the PR to launch it, and they did like a pop-up thing in a bike shop in London. Yep. And I was like, I was a big gamer as a kid, so I was like, this is awesome. I get to ride my bike and I'm basically on a game.
In a computer game.
I'm sold. I'm completely sold. And in London, the problem was so often... I'm you know, very blessed now living in the Peak District, but in London, the problem was, I've got blah, 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 whatever session it is that I've got to do. But I look at this session and I'm like, I don't know how I'm actually going to be able to do that in London. This is the middle of a city. You know, I lived in Shoreditch, I was bang in the center. Like,
right.
I could actually do quite a lot of like structured stuff in Regent's Park. That was quite close to me.
Okay.
The inner circle of Regent's Park is a 1 kilometer circle with a slight drag uphill. So like, it's actually quite good.
Yeah.
But the other option was if I rode to Richmond Park, that would be a, 45 minute ride there. My doorbell's having a disco. I'll be 1 second. I know exactly what it is as well. 1 second. My partner's got it. That saves. That's very useful. What was I saying?
Riding to Richmond Park.
Yeah, to go to Richmond would be like a 45 minute ride. While in contrast, like Regent's was like 20 minutes or so, but
yeah,
Richmond Park is great, but maybe not. If you get there early in the morning, like before traffic and the gates are open, it's really, really good because it's closed and there's just other cyclists in there. But when the traffic gets in there, it's very easy that it just becomes an absolute slog and you get stuck behind cars, especially on a hot summer day where there's loads of traffic there to park in. There's something that it just feels very wrong about a park, which is a green space, basically being used as a rat run by cars. But I could rant about that by anything, and I won't because that's bad.
I've ridden in Richmond Park twice, and I wasn't a fan.
Yeah, and the problem in London was so often that there was no, it's very hard to get to anywhere to be able to like train. And where I was, it was realistically an hour to an hour and a half to get to any good roads.
Yeah.
That's a lot of time out of the day. So I started using Zwift more because of the fact that I could be efficient with my time. If I had like an hour and a half session, as an hour and a half, that only takes an hour and a half, it doesn't take, an hour to get out of London,
then an hour and a half training.
So it became like quite an easy way to get some harder sessions in and some structure in. And then in contrast, now moving to the Peak District, and I think maybe as I've got older as well, like I'm hyper aware of safety on the bike.
Yeah.
I'll be honest, the drivers in the Peak District generally are really, really good. And I think a lot of that is the close proximity to British cycling. You see British cycling cars and riders out all the time. And I think that has actually really helped.
Yeah.
But other parts of the UK are definitely not as good. But I always have that concern of the safety aspect and anything where, you're going cross-eyed doing intervals outside. I don't feel that that is safe to be doing that. Right? So I'm quite happy to do those kind of really intervally sessions, like hard little sprints and stuff on a turbo trainer, because there's an element of safety that I'm, what's the worst that's going to happen? I'm going to fall off the turbo trainer.
Yeah.
That's not that bad, really. Like, and the turbo trainers are heavy. They don't really fall very easily. You had to really do something to make it fall over. And then I tend to do, like, I do a lot of sessions which are just like long, steady rides. And those kind of sessions, it's like, oh, of course, yeah, we've got 3.5 hours. I'm just going to go out and ride around the Peak District. And, you know, whatever the elevation is, that's going to dictate how I ride it, etc.
Yeah.
Same with the road surface. Like, obviously, I'm riding quite a lot off-road at the moment, which tends to be more power, more torque, slower, but also really, really fun. So,
yeah.
And also really dirty. My bike is filthy, dusty at the moment. But I think what Zwift has done so well, we saw a huge sort of growth in it over the pandemic, and maybe that has dropped off a bit. And then I reckon we see it spike up again in the winter months and probably drop down in the summer months. But it's provided a platform where people can race, train, socialize to an extent, because you have social rides. It's provided a huge new aspect to cycling, and I think it's incredibly positive. And we're obviously talking heavily about Zwift, but there are other programs that work in similar ways. I just think Zwift has probably been the one that's capitalized and grown and done the best out of it in terms of what they produced.
I haven't used any of the others, because I wasn't kind of racing when, for example, like RGT, I think, had some of the races over lockdown. Zwift is the one I've used. And like, obviously, well, so I did pay for a membership for a while. And then when I got on the Movistar E team, you know, they've got a partnership with Zwift, so we get free membership again. But I would happily pay for it. My husband pays for it. So, yeah, no, I think it's a really good kind of training resource.
Mm-hmm. It's... and they do free trials and stuff, so like if people haven't used it, and same with all of the programs, like RGT, Ruthie is another one that's out there.
There's
plenty of different options. The only my gripe with Ruthie is the way the avatars move looks really unnatural,
right? Okay.
And it's such a stupid, like, it's beautiful because it's like real roads and stuff that you ride on, but the avatars move in a really weird way and it looks really unnatural, and so I couldn't use it purely because of that, which is stupid, but hey-ho.
I think if you're a gamer as well, then you, like, you know, you're into like the graphics and everything as well. Like, I can understand that. It is cool. I do now really like it, and it definitely works, as you say, with some of those really intense sessions. I tend to just stick Zwift on, like, you know, a flat route where the gradient's not going to change mid-interval. But, you know, Zava said to me, I think it's actually better to do these like 2-minute efforts on the time trial bike on Zwift, because you can just put your head down, close your eyes and get it all out. Whereas on a road, you're going to be like, is there a car that's about to overtake me and turn? Is there a pothole I need to avoid? Like,
it's more additional things to think about. And especially time trialing, time and position is kind of the most valuable thing.
Yeah.
And you can do that so much easier on Zwift or any other virtual program.
Yeah.
Now, on the subject of time trialing, you're pretty good at time trialing. Let's not deny that. Very fast on a road bike on a time trial.
Yeah.
Very fast on a time trial bike on a time trial. And how, I think with time trialing, it's also a very unique thing to the United Kingdom, I feel.
It is a big niche in that, like, the UK compared to other places.
Yeah, it's like hill climbing and time trialing is such a... In the UK, we have this, first of all, to explain it to people that don't fully understand, we have British cycling, which kind of looks after what most people perceive as all the cycling stuff in the UK. And then we have CTT, which basically looks after the bit of cycling that not many people really understand unless you are, I guess, British and in the cycling community. Which kind of looks after time trialing and hill climbing, really. And you're obviously way more knowledgeable and experienced in it than I am, but how I've seen it is that, you know, British cycling in terms of time trialing follows the UCI rules.
Yeah.
CTT just goes, do what the fuck you want, basically.
CTT do have their own rules.
Yeah.
So, for example, if I were to ride the National Time Trial Championships that, you know, earns you the national champions jersey, governed by British cycling, I could ride a double disc if I wanted to, because the UCI rules, although they have different rules in terms of how long your extensions can be and how high they can be, they mm-hmm. don't have rules governing, for example, your front wheel. So you can use any front wheel you want. So I could use a disc. If I were to rock up and do the National 10, governed by cycling time trials, or any other event governed by cycling time trials, you can't, because they've got rules governing what percentage of your front wheel has to be uncovered. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole list of wheels that are like, I think there are like 4 spokes and 5 spokes that wouldn't be allowed. Obviously a front disc wouldn't be allowed. So there are, the CTT have their own rules that are different from the UCI rules.
Yeah, it's a minefield basically of confusion. Yeah. Because the UCI position rules on the bike are quite particular, but CTT doesn't have those kind of rules, if I'm correct.
Definitely not the same. They do have a couple of position rules. I think there was one that was like a 3-centimeter rule that was to do with like the position of your armrests and your elbows. And I can't remember the exact wording, but basically I used to always just set my bike up in a UCI legal position and ride that, because nothing about how my position was also fell foul of the CTT rules. And I'm as you said at the start, like although I do like change things, I'm very particular. It's like, well, I've tested this. This is the fastest. This is now how my bike is until the next time I test something and then change it. Like I definitely don't tinker day to day, to the extent where on my P5, I bought a spare seat post so that when I did some testing on saddle position, we could put the different saddle on the second seat post rather than playing with the angle or the position of the saddle on the original one. So it's like, well, this one is the one that we've tested and is set. Yeah. So we know that that works. So if we're going to play with it, we'll play with it on a separate seat post.
Nice. By doing it.
Yeah. So, you know, so, okay, yeah, I change things. But once it's like, this is what we're going with for the moment, it doesn't get messed with. So I'm not one of these people who would have, you know, for a CTT race, have a UCI illegal position that I ride every time I do CTT and then change it for UCI.
Now, what, I mean, to me, 2 time trial bikes for most people is probably overkill. Emphasis on most people. When I did the National 24s, I had 2 time trial bikes, and that was purely because if one had like a catastrophic problem, I could just swap. That was my stance. It's like, because it will be as fast being on effectively the same TT bike. It was the same frame. It was a giant trinity. I had 2 giant trinities, and the convenience of them was that they weren't crazy money as a frame, and it's a pretty fast bike. So I had 2 of them, but one was like top spec and one was very much not top spec. Was basically pieces of parts that I could find to kind of make it work. And the mindset was like, oh, if something goes wrong with the one I was racing on in the Nationals, I could effectively put the fast wheels on the not as high spec one and it'll be fine. It still worked fine. The position's the same. That obviously it was a luxury to be able to do that, and very lucky that I could, you know, I was financially in a position that I could afford to have 2. But, you know, being able to change and test things, like you say, just, you know, you've got with the P5, you've got the ability to have that second seat post, try and test saddles, and like time trialing saddles is like something that is the burden of my life. I just can't find one. I think I'm close to what I'm on now, but I've tried so many, and to be honest, a lot of the shorter stuff doesn't really matter so much. It's when it gets into like the 100-mile, 12-hour, 24-hour, that's when it matters.
Yeah.
I can't think of the name of the one that I've kind of settled on at the moment, but it seems pretty good of everything I've tried. It's just like, it's a position which I've always found as well on a time trial bike, you kind of need to like have time on that bike to get used to that position. So
yeah, you do.
And which some people think, oh, you could rock up to a TT and just, you know, be fine. But yeah, you might be fine. But in reality, time on the bike and time in the position is the most valuable thing with time trialing.
Yeah.
And being able to sustain that for long periods of time is obviously key. At the end of the day, it's fastest.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of time trialing, as we sort of briefly said, it's a very British, you know, United Kingdom thing. How I think personally, one of the reasons why I love it is the community side of it, and the you know, go to a village hall, get a shit coffee or cup of tea, get a bit of cake, like have a little weird conversation with some people who are just like, you're right, yeah, you're right, yeah, cool, put your kit on, go, come back, stare at a massive board of numbers and names, and you don't care about anyone's apart from yours.
Yeah.
There's no, what I like about it is no one really cares how anyone else does. People are very respectful of the fact that everyone is probably trying or doing their absolute best they can.
Yeah.
And everyone really kind of supports each other. And I love that. I think it's really nice compared to like the road racing side of things, where I think it's a bit more, especially on the men's side, there's definitely like a bit of like showboating and peacocking and like, you know, manly bullshit, which is just like, fuck off, like grow up, you know. I don't like that attitude.
No, I don't.
And time trialing seems to like wipe out a whole load of that bullshit and is much more back to the grassroots of the sport. Like there's no, yes, you can do it on a time trial bike, but at the same time, you could do it on a freaking Brompton if you wanted to.
Well, people do. So I came into cycling through, well, it was my husband that kind of, you know, introduced me to cycling, but I came into it through Cambridge University Cycling Club. And I came into cycling through time trialing. Like I didn't road race for years. And yeah, we have the University Cycling Club every October in one of the first weekends of term. They hold their freshers time trial. So it used to be 6 miles. I think it's now a 10. Mm-hmm. And yeah, people do it on town bikes. I think somebody did it on a unicycle once. Like, and it's just like, it's friendly. It's fun. It's a laugh. Like, as you say, people, it's kind of you against yourself.
Yeah.
At most levels, because, yeah, you know, a lot of local clubs will hold races on the same courses throughout the summer for a few months.
Yeah.
So you can go and do, you know, the E3310, you know, random course codes, which is the first TT course I ever did, just outside Cambridge. you can get a time, and then 2 weeks later you can go back, you can do it again, and you can say, okay, well, did I go faster? Like, yeah, all right, you get some differences with conditions and things like that, but you can actually like measure your own progress. So even if you don't have a power meter, which, you know, people coming into the sport, they're not going to have, but mm-hmm. you've got that, okay, well, it took me this amount of time to do this 10 mile course. And the first time I raced the E3310, I went round the roundabout at 5 miles, came out of the roundabout, somehow dropped my chain, stopped in a lay-by, put my chain back on, finished up with oil all over my hands. It took me like just over half an hour, I think, to do that race.
Mm.
And now, you know, I can do a 21 something on that course. And like, that is the course, and for injury reasons, I've not done it this year, but I race that course normally at least once a year, because for me, it's a really good measure of where I am in terms of like, you know, my fitness, my TTing, because I know what sort of time I can do on that course when I'm in really good shape versus maybe not in my peak condition. And I think Alex Dowsett does something similar with the Molden 10. You know, he goes back to the Molden 10, and like for him, he knows that course so well, like it's a really good measure of where he is. So that's one thing I love about time trialing. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if you do a 21 or a 30, like, you know, you go and have a cup of tea, even for the club, the weekday club tens, you know, they have, you know, the urns of hot water at the side of the road. So you still get your cup of tea after the race. Everyone's just sat around chatting about, you know, about bikes, about cycling, about whatever. And then, you know, you make good friends, you go back the next week, you do it again. And some of my favorite people that I have met through cycling have been the TT community.
I agree. It's a very it's very welcoming, and it's also my opinion is, if you're looking at potentially going into, you know, competitive side of cycling, it's a great entry into it.
Yeah.
It's probably the best.
You don't get dropped. You don't have that fear of failure that you do in a road race. It's like, well, what if I get dropped after like 3 miles?
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're getting into it as somebody who's a bit older and has that intrinsic understanding that actually bunch racing can be a bit dangerous and it's going to really hurt if you come off. You don't really have that with time trialing. Like, you know, it's not like, what if the person next to me decides to like switch me and that's, you know, broken elbow, broken collarbone, whatever.
Yeah.
It's a much more open way. And there are TTs everywhere. You know, you can probably ride out to your closest local time trial. Like there's one, we moved house a few years ago, just not very far, just like kind of 20, 25 minutes by car. But, you know, I'm now like a 20-minute ride from the start of, you know, a Thursday evening TT that they have kind of every week through the summer. So I can ride out there, warm up on my way out, do the race, ride back. Like, yeah, and it's just a nice kind of evening session.
Yeah, it's really, really fun. And it's one thing I haven't quite nailed, having moved to the Peak District, is finding, I haven't done any TTs this year. I do all of my indoor stuff on a TT bike, but I haven't done any TTs this year. And that's not intentionally. That is, I think, maybe because of the sort of challenges and stuff I've done, have been a bit more focused on off-road or going up a hill, it seems, or going up
a hill many days in a row, many times.
Yes.
That was insane.
Yeah, it was insane. It was stupid, and it really, really hurt.
It was impressive.
Yeah, it wasn't fun. That's just
type 2 fun.
Yeah, I think it was more like type 3 or type 4 fun, to be honest with you. It was the hardest. I was talking to someone about it yesterday, and they were like, oh, you know, how was it? I thought, well, it was hands down the hardest thing I've ever done. Hands down.
Yeah.
And so there just hasn't really been that much of a focus on time trialing, which is a shame because I do really enjoy it. And I think that's why I'm like, oh, well, in the winter, I'll do some like hill climb stuff, because it's quite often a very similar community.
It is. And it's one of those other things where with a hill climb, you can literally be riding an old town bike and taking like 3 times as long as everybody else. And people will be cheering you up the hill, banging wooden spoons on saucepan lids.
Probably more so if you're on a town bike as well, in all honesty.
Yeah.
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 And you see, if anyone listening wants to go and look at like photos, just search for like National Hill Climb UK and look at some of the photos from it, because the atmosphere is insane and you get these closed climbs and they're just covered in people. Doesn't really matter what the weather is like.
And they're always, the National Hill Climb is always the last weekend in October. Yeah. So not warm, because quite often as well they're up north in the UK, because that tends to be where a lot of the hills are. And you'll get people in mankinis on the side of the road running up with saucepans and wooden spoons.
Yeah, that's a good way of describing it. Mankinis, saucepans and wooden spoons. Welcome to the hill climb season in the UK.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. It's slightly disturbing, but beautiful at the same time. Now, one thing I wanted to sort of wrap up and talk about is, what would be your like biggest, for three different things actually, maybe four, your biggest tips in terms of time trialing for someone who's looking to get into time trialing, and for I guess also specifically on then the women's side of the sport, someone who is looking to get into road racing or time trialing on the women's side of the sport, And then lastly, equally, I'd say down, you know, because you've ticked off road racing at such a high level, you've ticked off time trialing at such a high level, and then also the esports, what would be your tips for each of those categories on how to kind of get involved or into that side of thing? And I thinking of it, because I don't know how to do it as a guy, but I think there's a very different, probably, I obviously don't know what it's like coming from that as a woman's perspective. I was talking to someone about it the other day. It's like, I can fully empathize with it, but I can never truly understand it as a white male. Like, I can't, I can't, there's nothing I could do about that, unfortunately. But, no. From a women's side of the sport, like, how would you look at getting into time trialing, the e-racing, and I guess, just racing in general, really? What would be your kind of tips to get involved in it?
So in terms of just people getting into time trialing, I would say don't worry about what equipment you've got. Like, literally, if you want to try a time trial, just take whatever bike you normally ride, find the local clubs in your area, go on their website, find where they have local evening time trials, because almost all of them do, to be honest. And reach out. They're really friendly. Like, if you're unsure, send an email, say, look, how do I turn up to this 10? And most local clubs will have come and try it events, which means you don't need to be a club member in order to do the race. And the only reason that they try and get you to be a club member is insurance. It's not a, like, we're trying to get you in. It's a, you need to be insured for time trialing. But most clubs have come and try events. So just go along, see if you like it. Don't worry about what equipment you've got. It's just you against yourself. It's like doing a hard training session and just, you know, seeing what comes out at the end of it. But it's with other people, and it's probably easier to push yourself harder if it's a competition. Mm-hmm. And the beauty of TTing is, if you're specific with your training, you can actually be really successful at a 10 or a 25 mile time trial on, you know, 10 hours or maybe even less a week. You don't need to put hours and hours into it, because you're training for an event that's maybe an hour long if you're doing 25s or just over an hour. So that's great for time trialing. So reach out. Like, ask for help, find a local club, and the local clubs are generally really, really friendly and helpful.
I guess as well, like, the in terms of, like, don't care about what equipment you've got, the fastest bike for the person is always going to be the bike you ride the most.
Yeah.
It's what you're
comfortable on. It's what you're used to. But, like, yeah, don't worry if you're doing it on a road bike versus someone on a time trial bike. I did loads of races last year that were open time trials, so you could ride, you know, your normal time trial bikes. I did loads of them on my road bike. I was beating a lot of people on TT bikes as well, but if I wasn't beating them, I didn't mind, because at the end of the day, at that point, I was trying to see what can I do on a road bike.
Mm.
I say a good road bike. It was my original road bike, like the first kind of good road bike I have, it was from 2011, so it was actually a very old frame, but I did have a lot of nice Aerocoach goodies on it. So.
It very slippery, basically.
I tried to, still didn't quite get the time that I wanted to, but that project can be paused until I have time again. So.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And then, like, with the esports side of it, how would you, because I think there's going to, in winter we're going to see people getting more involved in it again. What would you say are the best things or little things that you would suggest to people to have or to do in terms of training indoors?
So I would, in terms of stuff that you definitely need while training indoors, fans. Yeah. I didn't understand the importance of a good fan and multiple fans until I did the eSport World qualifiers. So until that point, I was just using a £20 Amazon Basic, like, little desktop fan. And then when I wanted to do the continental qualifiers, I was asking Zav for advice as well and things, obviously, and he was like, get better fans. And then I raced the world championships from the Aerocoach offices, And so I had my fan there, but also the fans that like they have in their kind of Bike Fit Studios WIF room. And like, it makes such a big difference. So definitely invest in fans. Otherwise, in terms of like...
This is the key word of that as well. Multiple fans.
Multiple. Yeah. I'm turboing in the summer, I have three. I've got a big one and two mini ones.
I have two massive floor ones. When I'm turboing. And then on my like turbo room is on the first floor of my house. And I've got a, like, it's up there. That's what I'm putting it. There's a balcony and the Zwift room is that side.
Yeah.
Basically, window open on the balcony, windows open there, and it becomes like a real like
through draft
that comes through, plus the two fans. And I still think that probably isn't enough. In all
honesty, I have to say, one of the most grim things I've done, obviously in the UK, we have had a heat wave, we're kind of in another one, but we made international news with recording over 40 degree temperatures. During that week of the 40 degrees, I was still restricted to indoor riding at a pretty low heart rate because of where I was post surgery. So that was the first day I was allowed to do a 2-hour session at 140 beats per minute was when it was 40 degrees. And I was on the turbo. And I think my power was still as rubbish as it had been at doing 110 beats per minute because my heart rate was through the roof just because of the heat. And that was... That was a really unpleasant few hours, but I couldn't do anything about it. But.
Yeah, I think when in that week I was going out just in the evenings and not, I was just kind of like, there's no point in doing anything stupid because it could be quite dangerous. So I was just going out on my mountain bike and riding along the canals in the evenings for a couple of hours.
The good thing about mountain bike is like it is a bit cooler because... Like if you're in the forest, for example, you are under shade, but I don't think anything would help that week. But
dog definitely didn't enjoy it. Let's just say that much.
No.
And he's okay at the moment, but yeah, that week was, he's a Labradoodle, so he's furry.
No, that was for him. But I think in terms of getting into Zwift racing, I think one good thing is there are lots of different courses on offer because, again, there are races, like several races every hour, you know, during the main part of the day. So look at the course or look at, the rough kind of information about the courses and find something that you think is going to suit your strengths. So if you're not a great climber, you know, go for one of the flatter routes to begin with. If you actually really like the climbs, especially like if you're good at like short sharp climbs, do like Innsbruck Ring where you've got one kind of 2-minute climb a lap or something like that that's relatively steep. So you know, find a course that suits your strength as a rider, and obviously with the normal races you don't need to do any of the prerequisite like weigh-in, power testing, this, that, and the other. Those are any things you need to worry about when you are really into Zwift racing and want to do the kind of Zwift Racing League events.
Yes.
So just find a race that suits your strengths, sign up to the power level that you're currently at, and it doesn't matter what that is, and work your way up. And just enjoy it. Like don't stress about it too much. Don't try and take it too seriously. Just do what you can. Like the physics of racing on Zwift are different. Like if you get gapped, you will end up getting dropped. And it's just because of the way that the drag physics work on Zwift. So like, don't be disheartened. Just try another one and get more used to how it operates as a game. And actually one thing that can be good about learning how to do that is joining a pace partner ride. You could join a pace partner ride of a power to weight category that's actually comfortable for you. You can get yourself to the back of the group, leave a bit of a gap, and then try and get back on. And doing things like that, you can work out when you're in the draft how to move around the group, and then that will help with your racing.
It's you raise a good point there that it is very much a different type of bike racing to
It's a skill.
That's why we see real specialists in Zwift racing now. Like it's a very different type of racing to being outdoors. Yeah, and yes, like you know, being able to churn out big power numbers is great. But as you say, that how drafting and stuff works on it is all kind of weird, and no one truly knows how they've done that. But it's very different to riding outdoors.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing you see. Like, okay, Ashley Moorman-Passio is maybe a bit different because she invested in, like, learning the platform, and she won the first Esports World Championships, and and she was, you know, she was right up there in the results this year. But she's one of the few. And when you actually see, when you saw, I think it was RGT hosted, like, a version of the Women's Tour, or also, like, you know, they hosted a couple of races that were, like, Tour de France-esque. When you saw those races, actually, it wasn't the, like, the Anna van der Breggens who were winning the online racing. It was the people who'd done more virtual riding, because it's a different skill.
Completely says it all. And then I had one last question to ask, actually. What of all of your wins results is the one you're most proud of? Because there's a lot to, I appreciate there's a lot to choose from.
I think I've possibly got, I think I've got two. Can I have two?
You can have two.
So, Commonwealth Games bronze medal.
Very relevant as well in terms of, we just had the Commonwealth Games.
And I was working there last week. So, I mean, I've won two international medals. I won a European Games bronze in 2019 and a Commonwealth Games bronze in 2018. But the Commonwealth Games bronze, like, it was a reward and the culmination of a really, really focused winter. Like, I basically, because that year the Commonwealth Games were in the April, so it was basically the start of a season for me. At that time my husband was still coaching me, and we were like, right, well, you want to hopefully be selected for Commonwealth Games, and you want to do as best you can in that time trial. And so everything was just focused, and I put my head down. I didn't do anything else. Like, everything was, is this going to make me better for the Commonwealth Games? Yes or no? If yes, do it. If no, sorry, no. And like 3 weeks out of that, from that race, I was so tired. I was in a hole. I was knackered because I'd trained so hard. And then, like, you know, tapered down, recovered, went to the race, executed, you know, the race that I wanted to have, and just had a really good result. And, like, as well as being third, you know, I was 17 seconds behind Linda Willemsen, I think, in that race. And, you know, she's an ex-world champion, won countless events. So I was just really proud of how that all came together. And obviously it wasn't just me and Mark, because, you know, Zav did my error testing for that. It was team efforts, you know. But, like, you know, my small kind of team that I had at the time, like, everybody was just so focused and helpful and just wanted me to do well. So that was one. The other one, strangely, might sound strange, is when I won the National Hill Climb in 2019. Because when I first started cycling in, well, 2011 was when I did, like, my first kind of evening time trials. I was pretty overweight. Like, I wasn't in great shape. I've always been quite fit because I did the, you know, I did the women's boat race in 2009, when it was still at Henley. So I've always been fit, but, like, I put on weight quite easily. And once I stopped rowing, and before I really started cycling, I put on a lot of weight. So when I started time trialing, I was still pretty heavy, and I hated hills. And I was like, I love Cambridgeshire because it's really flat and there's nothing that I have to go up. And I would avoid climbs. And, you know, I have memories of when we'd been on training camps in Spain, and I was just so miserable every time I was faced with a mountain. These days I love it. I love long climbs, you know, can't get enough of it. I'm getting bored of Cambridge being so flat. But part of, like, my journey in cycling is the fact that I've gone from actually probably a bit of an unhealthy weight to being in really good physical shape. You know, I lost, I think, from when I started to when I won the elite national title in 2015, I lost like 45 kilos.
Bloody hell. Like,
difference of 45, which is the same weight as you know, some of these actual like tiny little climbers that are the pure climbing specialists. So for me, winning the national hill climb in 2019, and actually like a couple of years before that, winning the Box Hill climb with course records and things like that. But winning the national hill climb in 2019 was a real like, this is where I've got to, like this is how far I've come since the first, you know, 30 minute 10 I did back in 2011. And this is now the rider that I am and that I want to be. Like, I like the hills. I, you know, I can't wait to go back to Spain and be riding up mountains again. Yeah, like I did a ride with Zav and Jess in Malvern recently, and like it was such a nice change from being in the flatlands of Cambridge. It's like, oh, hills, I know what these are. These are fun. Yeah, so it's just like, it was a real marker of like my cycling journey, I think. So I'm really proud of that, even though it's, you know, a very niche win area of like British sport.
Such a cool one though. It's such I'm a proud cool of it. One. Yeah, it's really cool. I find it, the whole relationship between cycling and weight is, you know, I was at my biggest, I was a very overweight child. I come from a family of large people. I say large in the sense that they're not tall. They're very wide. You know, when I was, until I would have been, let me think, I was like 120 kilos at one point. And that was probably until... Well, I was 120 kilos, probably until 2016-ish.
Right.
And then I started, 2016 is like when I sort of started riding and doing the sort of charity challenges as well. That was the first one was in 2016. And I was still big then. And then the lightest, I sort of sit probably between, I would say 75 and 83 kilos, and any lighter than 75 and then I lose all power and I'm always cold and
get ill easily, probably
get ill easily. I probably sit a happy weight is probably about 80, I'd say.
Yeah,
between, you know, high 70s, low 80s. And cycling does have a very, I think, an unhealthy relationship with weight.
I completely agree.
And I think I understand it. Why? I understand the power to weight ratio aspect of it, but also the bit that I think doesn't help to it. And maybe it's starting to change slightly, but I think the bit that doesn't help is that, you know, you think of like Chris Froome era of winning the Tour de France. Tall, thin, you know, you see these riders that are winning the top tier races, the Tour de France or whatever it was. And the guys that win up the mountains and they're skeletal.
Yeah.
And I think that probably hasn't helped because people go, oh, you know, I need to look like that if I'm going to win stuff. But I feel like slowly, emphasis on slowly, starting to change when we're seeing riders like Wout van Aert winning.
And Podjapa's not the smallest guy. Like,
big guy. You know?
And that's why I really like as well, like, Van Vleuten's kind of dominance, because she is not, you know, the lightest, like absolute stick, but she's getting away from everyone else on these long climbs.
Yeah.
And she herself has said, like, you know I can get to X weight for maybe like 1 week a year for a key race. But the rest of the time, I don't sit with that. And, you know, she's very open and honest about that. And she knows that she can't try and be at that weight all year. And she's not constantly like, oh, well, when I'm lighter, I go faster and I win more. Therefore, I just need to keep getting lighter. And I think that's
something like that.
I think that's a dangerous thing that actually I have seen reinforced. You know, people lose a lot of weight. Suddenly they start winning stuff or performing a lot better. So they're like, well, I'm going to get even better if I lose more. And then it gets to a dangerous place. And I find that really sad. But I think sometimes the environment that you're in is not very helpful, because, you know, we've all heard stories, actually, particularly I think on some of the women's teams, where you know, that you have old school managers, they tell you, oh, you're eating too much, you're overweight, like, and you need the kind of new generation of managers and sports scientists and stuff to come in and be like, actually, no, like, we can work out what a healthy kind of sustainable weight is for you and will help you achieve that and like not push you to go further.
The other side of it is that I think I'm terrible for forgetting is that me at 80 kilos, that is an average weight across 30. I forgot how old I was yesterday, which was quite worrying. 32 year old, you know, say early to mid 30 year old men.
Yeah.
To be 80 kilos is a very healthy weight.
Yeah.
Incredibly healthy weight. And I'm definitely really bad at it is that I would compare myself to other cyclists as opposed to comparing myself to other men
of your age.
And I think it's very similar. I think everyone's very similar in that context in cycling, that you forget actually the cycling bubble is very niche. There is a niche of a niche of a niche. Like it's a tiny, tiny percentage of people in the world compared to everything else. And then the other person while you were talking about that as well, that I was thinking about, and we look at, you know, you mentioned Van Vleuten, like she's very like barrel chested, you know, she's clearly got huge lungs on her and huge capacity to get oxygen in. I was watching the women's tour and I was thinking like, she almost looks, and I don't mean this in a horrible way, but she almost looks how she rides doesn't look very natural, but as part of what makes her who she is and how strong she is.
Yeah.
Because she is incredibly, you know, barrel chested and obviously has these massive lungs in her. I mean, the other person that I was thinking about that I massively thought this through when I watched the sub seven Christian Blumenfeld, he's a big guy. Like, he looks like a, you know, a big, broad, huge, like chest and stomach on him. This is the guy that's done the fastest Ironman ever. And you look at him and you think, I remember looking at him thinking, and I've fought it all the time with him because I'm incredibly amazed by his, you know, athleticism and strength, but he looks like a big guy, you know?
Yeah.
And it shows that why it was so lovely to see. I mean, I really do think he shouldn't wear the white skin suits, I'll be honest, because it's completely white. But you see someone like him as well, who is very clearly has, you know, he's incredibly fit. Let's not deny that. And same with Van Vleuten, she's incredibly fit, but they look, it's a bit more relatable, you know, as opposed to someone that's a stick.
And that's why, like, you know, I hope that younger kids, younger people coming into the sport can look at athletes like that and realize that you don't have to be one thing. You don't have to be one particular body shape or anything else. And like, And going away from the elite side of things, you know, hopefully a lot of people can come into cycling and just like use it for a bit of fitness, just to get that bit fitter. And it doesn't matter what size or shape you are. Like, yes, okay, I've lost a load of weight, but through cycling, but not because I was like, oh, I need to be skinny. I need to be a certain thing. But like, you know, I got fitter. I got, you know, competitive. And I got healthier, but like, you know, don't feel that you can't race if you're, you know, 80 kilos, 90 kilos, whatever, like you can still just use it as fitness. Like you don't need to be a certain thing. And I think that's one really great thing for cycling. And I think coming back to what you were asking about, like females getting into the sport, like I think a lot of women worry about like outward appearance, not just in terms of their physical appearance, but like how well they will or won't do in a certain event. Also maybe nervousness of riding on like open roads. I know that's a barrier to a lot of women cycling. They're a bit worried about, you know, how they deal with aggressive drivers or people doing whatever. And I think another thing, just coming back to where we started, like clubs. Find local clubs. They're really friendly. They'll have women's rides. You know, you can ride with other women. You don't have to ride with the men. Like, that even if there's just a female within that club that might then be able to say, you know what, I'll come for a ride with you. Like, I happily would do that with people as well. You know, just they're really friendly atmospheres. Nobody cares, like, what you look like, what kit you're wearing when you go to an evening 10, because at the end of the day, everyone's there for the same thing. Everyone's there to have fun riding their bike, get a little bit fitter, and like test themselves. It doesn't have to be a worry about, you know, what your time's going to be at the end of the day, or, you know, what you look like. It's just everyone's there because they love cycling.
I think that's an amazing way to wrap everything up. Basically, in summary, more people on bikes is better.
Yep.
Cars are bad. Let's all get electric cars because they're a bit better. And time trialing is fun. And don't worry what you look like.
Yeah.
That's how I'm going to summarize everything.
Yeah.
There you go. 30-second podcast. Done.
Sorted. Don't need to listen to the rest of it.
Please listen.
But please do. We had a nice chat. Please do.
Please listen to all of it. Like, subscribe, comment, all that crap. I hate saying it. I never say it. I don't know why I said it, but I'm going to go. Hayley, thank you so, so much for taking some time out this morning to talk with me about, like, your really, I mean, I've always followed you for years and thought, like, wow, you've done some amazing things and very diverse things, which is cool as well. Yes, we've sort of said maybe you're quite honed into time trialing, but you know, you've kind of ticked off everything: hill climbs, road racing, time trialing, e-racing. Like, it's really, really cool to see.
The diversity might be increasing as well, so watch this space.
Cyclocross, gravel, triathlon.
No, I can't run. I've always been told not to run. I'm hypermobile in my lower body, so that's a bad thing.
Okay. Skiing.
Yeah, anyway.
Anyway,
Jesus.
I reckon that you're going to start playing darts professionally. That's my take.
Yeah, that's it.
Anyway, you heard it here first. Hayley's going to be playing darts professionally. She's going to go for... I couldn't tell you anything about darts, so I'm already useless. It's going to be a professional darts person thing, throwing darts at bullseyes.
Yeah.
Heard it here first. Anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you.